You're listening to Cadence, a podcast for creatives. I'm Hafsa.
And I'm Yen.
And if you're new to the podcast, Cadence is a conversation around topics that we wish we'd been more informed on when we started out on our career paths. The hope is to arm you, the listener, with some takes and tips that might be of service as you venture out on your own unique path. And just to have a cool conversation with some cool people like Hayan over here. Welcome, Hayan.
Thanks for having me. I don't know how cool I am, and hopefully I can provide some insights, but I also wish I had something like this when we first started.
Oh, right? Yes. Us too.
Exactly.
We first want to thank Fifth Avenue Studios and out of Ann Arbor District Library for allowing us to record in this wonderful space and collaborating with us on producing this podcast. But Hein, I think you are cool because your role is as chief prophecy fulfiller and co-owner of Huck Finch. It's a strategic design studio out of Ypsilanti. And before you started that, you had a personal development blog called Chilled Pill that showed people how to live up to their potential. I am going to ask you at some point about being temporarily ordained as a Buddhist monk, but I know that you are just a lifelong learner and you are constantly collaborating with fellow entrepreneurs, and that is how you continue to shape your life and business. So now I'm very, very intrigued.
Same here.
Yeah. What's your story?
My story is I just beg, borrow, and steal from other people that are awesome and
make it my own thing. Right?
But yeah, I'll just touch on the title. Like, it's just something goofy because, like, at the end of the day, like, when we started Huck Finch, so much of, I think the business in general and so much of, in life is not only like knowing what you want, but also what you don't want.
Yes.
And it was very clear from the beginning with Huck Finch that I knew what I didn't want, which was I never wanted to wear a suit ever again because I came from a consultancy background. So okay. I was like, so I never want to go to a workplace that requires me to wear a suit. So I don't want customers like that. And also I realized like I had, you know, fancy titles at the previous workplace and I didn't honestly care about the titles. Sure. I didn't mean anything.
Some people do. Yeah.
And so the chief prophecy fulfiller thing was just kind of like a middle finger to the whole title thing where it's like, it doesn't matter. Like, it just ultimately matters what I'm able to do.
That's
like,
right.
I could not have any title at all.
Right.
So, just because your title says managing partner or CEO, or whatever, it doesn't mean you actually live up to that title.
Good point. That's a good point. Yeah. Sometimes titles are just the inflated ideas that we hope to bring.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they're just purely a vanity thing. And it's like, I don't care. Like, I just want to be able to help out and do good things.
So how did you get to this place? Because I am so much on board with the what you say no to. Mm-hmm. Like, how do you protect your time, your mind, your emotions, all of that? But what was the path that got you to that place? Because you said you started at a consultancy where you did wear suits. So what was the experience, education, life path that got you here?
Yeah. So I'll try to hit this as quick as I can. So I'm originally from California. I was born to an immigrant and a refugee, both from Vietnam. And then I came out to Michigan for college. And as I would jokingly say, as any good Asian kid, I was pre-med. I was applying to medical school.
Check.
I'd taken the MCAT. Uh-huh. And I was in my secondaries and realized, like, oh, man, I don't want to do this. Oh. Like, if I go down this path, I'm going to continue to be a doctor, which I don't want to be. But then I still decided to be in healthcare because I had spent a summer in Nepal doing, like, volunteer work there to kind of, like, beef up my medical school resume and realize, like, hey, this is other avenue in healthcare that I can do where I can provide community impact.
Yeah.
So I became a hospital administrator, worked for the VA for a little bit, left that, and then joined a consultancy where I was a first employee. They were just starting, and we were implementing electronic health records. Long story short, ultimately, I met my business partner, Matt, there. He was employee number three, and we just decided that we were treating the business like it was our own, and we were never going to get a piece of it, and it wasn't our own. You know, we were, you know, any good business, we were drinking old fashions at Raven's Club and realized we should do our own thing, you know, with some liquid courage.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of it came down to this idea of the American dream, where it's like, mm-hmm. oh, if you work hard and you go to school, you get good grades, you'll be able to be happy and fulfilled. Yes. And I had all those things. I went to a good school. I had a good job. I had the title. Uh-huh. And I wasn't fulfilled. I wasn't happy. And I just felt like I was just kind of like just existing to exist. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so we're talking with Matt, and we're just philosophizing, talking, because I had minored in Buddhist studies. He minored in philosophy at Eastern. Mm-hmm. And we're like, hey, we have a mutual connection here. And this mm-hmm. is how we're using these things. And so that's how Chill Pill came about. Uh-huh. And that's when I learned how to like actually do design work. I grew up creative, but I never had developed a website before that. Okay. I didn't know anything about email marketing, mm-hmm. SEO. So it's all contextual, the learning for me. Mm-hmm. The blog gained popularity. We gave workshops, and some of the people who attended the workshops are business owners, and are like, hey, can you adopt some of these workshops for our business? Mm. And we said, sure. And then we did them, and then they're like, what do we do with this now? It's like, put up on your website. People would love to know like the purpose of your business and yeah. what your vision is and your mission, all that. And then they were like, can you help? And knowing that we have the skill set at that point, we're like, yeah. Uh-huh. So we kind of just backdoored our way into starting a design studio.
That's hilarious.
Yeah, we just kept saying yes to something. And then I got to a point where like, oh, okay. Now I can start saying no, because I don't want to do MailChimp setup. I don't want to be known as the MailChimp guy.
Right.
Pick and choose what you want to do.
Yeah.
So you were the first employee, and Matt was the third employee. What happened to the second? You just left them out.
He worked in a different area.
Okay,
so, yeah.
Okay,
but
okay.
like Matt and I got together and uh-huh. we connected because we were both implementing electronic health records together. So we were managing projects together. So we were kind of going back and forth with each other. You know, as any startup, if anybody's worked in them, like they don't have policies, they don't have procedures. You kind of have just to figure them out as you go. And, wow. and we kind of just worked off of each other. And so we kind of never worked on a project together, but we supported each other, and we like got a good vibe of how to work together.
What a great origin story. I love how you synergize through your likeness, mm-hmm. your abilities, and then also just the spirit in which you knew what you wanted to do for people, and again, what you did not want to do ever mm-hmm. again.
Yeah.
Wow, I love that.
Yeah, and like you know, I don't want to make the conversation about like that consultancy, but we left for a reason. You know, like there's a lot of things that we didn't like, things we would have changed the day if it was our business. So so intentionally, when we started Huck Finch, we were very like clear about certain things that we didn't want it to mm-hmm. be. Like we didn't want to wear suits, so we're not going to go after certain specific types of clients. We wanted right away for people to see the website and our vibe, like mm-hmm. either you're going to love us or you're going to hate us, which is fine with me. Right. I don't want to, I'm not here to get everybody. And the other thing was, they had this weird vision of like, oh, we want to grow the company to like 50 people or something by 2020, sure. something like that. And I'm very much a why person. So mm-hmm. I'm like, mm-hmm. but I was like, why? Why does this matter? Like if we hit 49 by 2020, did we fail? Like mm-hmm. What is this?
It's the goal set for.
Yeah, what's this obsession with this number? Mm-hmm. And so that was because of that conversation, we were very much like, can we do this with two guys? Like mm-hmm. What can we grow and what can we build with two guys only? What this constraint mm-hmm. that allows us to be more creative, I think, rather than be like, oh, we got more business. Let's bring in another person. Let's mm-hmm. keep hiring and hiring. Mm-hmm. When we can be like, how do we scale this as much as we can?
Well, I kind of love that you said that too, because I think, you know, maybe that's a misconception a little bit. I mean, especially in tech, but maybe also, you know, just in design and starting businesses, of like these sort of seemingly arbitrary goals that people set for themselves of like, we have to get to, you know, X number of this or X number of employees and stuff like that. And I guess I'm curious for you, what does growth look like? Because if you're comfortable with the types of clients that you have a very sort of concerted approach to who you want to work with and the kind of work that you want to do, and you're comfortable with being two people, then what does growth look like in that situation?
Yeah. So from a vision standpoint of where we want Huck Finch to grow. So we think of like Chill Pill as the holding company for everything, because like Chill Pill still exists. It technically owns Huck Finch. Mm. But the way we see it is that like we want to add new business lines that are very intentional about the problems that they solve. Mm-hmm. So almost kind of like, since we're here in Ann Arbor, it's almost kind of like Zingerman's like community of business where like the bakehouse does a particular thing. You know, the Roadhouse does a thing. Like, you know, they're all very specific and like what their goals are. Mm-hmm. There's some overlaps, obviously, but they have a clear reason to exist. Mm-hmm. And for the growth of like Chill Pill Holding, it's like essentially like, well, what is Huck Finch for? Mm-hmm. And Huck Finch is really for B2B growth and late stage tech companies that need a rebrand or need to replatform the webflow because their marketing team is just struggling to use their existing website because creating a new blog post takes like 3 days when it should take 3 minutes, you know, like, and part of their growth is through content. So that's what Huck Finch is for. That's the audience we serve. We recently started a new studio a few months ago called Grab Bag. Mm-hmm. And that one's for early stage startups from pre-seed, Series A. And their challenges are very different. Because for them, it's like they have tighter budgets. They tend to have tighter turnaround times because they're like, hey, I'm going to like start to raise around and I need a new website for this because I need this to present well to investors. Mm-hmm. So it's totally different, like
kind of audience
and their needs and the type of business that we offer them is different too. Mm-hmm. It's much faster. It's very sprint like focused and more prescriptive because in working with early stage, they tend to be first time founders. And they don't know what they don't know kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And they focus on things like, well, I don't know if I really love this color blue or out of these three logos, which one is it? It's like, no, it's just this. Move on. Like, you know, like this is the logo. You need to think about product market fit. You need to think about generating revenue because that's how you're going to like raise around. Like your investors aren't going to care what shade of blue you're going with or your logo. Right. Like you can think about this later when you have more money.
That's right.
Like
that's
you need to be going to market. You need to be validating your product. That's what matters to you right now. Mm-hmm.
Wow, we all need a hind on our shoulders giving us the pep talk. Honestly. I mean, when you're talking about serving that mid-level versus the starting out organization, how can we go back to when you started your organization? Like, did you know going into it how to do that? Or how much learning did you have to do to say, this is how I'm doing it and this is the paperwork? Like, you sound so comfortable in your positioning now, but can you think back to when you started Huck Finch?
Yeah. So I would be lying if I said this was all intentional, but a lot of it was a carryover because of the experience of working with this other like a consultancy. In that, like, I didn't like the way they price, and I forever was talking about we need to change our pricing model. We need to change this. It just doesn't make any sense. Mm. And so these things I knew that were critically important to a business, like I really kind of focused on that. Mm-hmm. And I think the other nice thing about coming as a non-designer is like I don't know what the box is to color within. Like, I can't just like replicate my time working at another design studio and then just copy and paste it. Like, I don't know what that looks like. I only know from like, how does this typically work? And then I look at it, I'm like, I don't want to do it that way. I can fix that. I don't want to.
I'm the rebel. Yes.
Yeah. Like, I think it doesn't have to be done a certain way. It can be done differently. And I was like, I don't like the idea of meeting with a prospect and, you know, then just giving them a random number for a website or a brand. And I don't even know how many pages they want. So how the hell do I know what this is? Mm-hmm. It's like, and they're going to look at it and be like, is this the right number? Like, and so I'm like, why don't I incorporate what we started, which was more workshop based because we had to fit it within our work schedule. So I was like, let's just start with an initial workshop. We're going to go through, we're going to really strategically think through what you need and want, because that's part of like my strength, I guess, is that like coming from the project management background is like, I look at it from more of a business strategic perspective and then using design to facilitate solutions. Nice. And so I'm like, okay, like what do we need to do actually? What are all the integrations? Like, what is the core objective that you want out of this website? You need people to convert. Like, do we have these things here? Like, do we need to integrate this with Calendly or whatever tool, like HubSpot? Now that I fully know the scope of this and you are along the way with me to figure this out, like I can give you a real price and you'd be like, yeah, this seems right. Versus like, I don't know, like here's the price, like pay me. It was like, what am I getting for that? It's like, I don't know. I don't know if I'm even charging you enough. Yeah. So like, I think that's somewhat meandering, but it was kind of like a pulling things I knew I didn't like and didn't want and just testing it out to see if it would work. Mm-hmm. And then others was like, well, I've never done this before. Let me try how other people have done it and then decide if I like it or don't and then tweak it. And that was part of how Chill Pill started as the blog, because I had never written a blog before. And so I, like I said at the top, like I just begged, borrowed, and steal my way to where I am. And I'd say that jokingly, but I also say that seriously because I was like, well, who's out there that I like content wise? Like, mm-hmm. oh, I like James Clear. Like, what do I like about his blog? So let me just structure my blogs the same way as he does mm-hmm. it. And then after a while, I was like, okay, I don't like writing this way because it's devoid of personality. Mm-hmm. It's laborious for me because it feels like a chore. Like, let me try writing something different. And I tried it differently, and then the response was much better. I was like, let me try that again. Maybe that was in the, like a one-time thing. And it was the same reception. I was like, okay, so this is going to be my writing style moving mm-hmm. forward. And so, yeah, so we've kind of done the same thing with the studios where it was like, let's try this out. Mm-hmm. If it doesn't work, let's not do it anymore. If it does, then let's keep going with it. Like, no ego, I guess.
Yeah, no, I love that. No ego, absolutely, is what I live by. And I like when you were kind of describing, you know, your studio's approach to working with clients, because it sounds like it's the ongoing journey of searching for context, right? Mm-hmm. Too many people start, you know, trying to problem solve from the top level, from the like, oh, I need a logo, I need messaging, I need, you know, a product. And you're really starting from that base layer, which is, what is it you're trying to do? Mm-hmm. What is your fundamental goal? And what do you want to get out of this entire thing?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I'm the salesperson on the other two. Like, I think one thing we realized over time is that we're both curious and interested in every aspect of the business, mm-hmm. but then at some point we realize like this duplicity is not good for the business, and sure. we are blind to ourselves that like we do like care enough about this particular thing. I'm not saying Matt doesn't care about the sales side, because he does, but he doesn't want to do that's not his thing.
Yeah.
And I care about the client experience, but like I don't care enough to like shape it the way that he does. I just know what I want out of it, and right. he can think through the thing. But part of like the sales, like I try to disarm, at least for myself, like to think through. I was like, well, what does the prospect's journey look like? Most likely they're going to be talking to a bunch of different studios. So one, how can we stand out?
Right.
Like, so we can't use this copy of like stand out from your crowd, because ironically enough, like, yeah, it's not standing out from the crowd, because every other design studio has that message. And then the other thing is like, well, they're going to talk to everybody. Like, this needs to look different. It needs to sound different. And the experience of first talking to me needs to be different. Mm-hmm. And knowing that they're going to talk to a bunch of studios, I just immediately say, I know you're looking at a bunch of different studios. Mm-hmm. The reality is, most likely, whomever you go with, you're going to get a good looking website.
Mm.
So that's not what I'm promising you. I'm promising you everything else. Like, these other studios are only promising you a good looking website.
It's okay.
Like that's already a given. That's mm-hmm. table stakes. It's everything else.
What is your everything else?
It's the strategic part of thinking through, like, a bit from a business standpoint, like, how is this thing serving your business? Mm-hmm. How is it fitting within your business stack, your tech stack? Mm-hmm. And then especially on the Hook Finch side, it's like, what is your marketing team workflow look like, so I can set up the back end of the site to mm-hmm. best facilitate your work to make this as efficient and as effective as possible? Because I think a lot of times people think about the UX and user experience on the front end for the customers, but they don't think about it for the actual users.
Right. Yeah.
And at the end of the day, like, if I can't get the content creators to be able to produce content,
right,
that website is gonna die on the vine.
Yeah, there's mm-hmm. no content.
There's no content, and that user experience on the front end can't be great because there's no new content. And mm-hmm. so, like, I need to be thinking about them.
Yeah.
And more likely, as I think about them, then I can think about how they're going to best serve their audience. Mm-hmm. So it's all those things mm-hmm. that I focus my time talking about versus like about, you're gonna get bomb looking stuff with us, because
right.
I already said you're going to get that from anybody.
It doesn't, no, it's
right. Yeah.
But no, we're also going to set you up for success.
Right.
Not everybody can do that.
Yeah.
I love that. So I kind of want to dig in. This is a little bit more about your background, but I want to try and tie it to, you know, everything that you've talked about in terms of, you know, working with clients and being, you know, a very strategic thinker in, you know, terms of your travel. Like, you've traveled a lot. You've been to different places. Maybe you can give some more color to that. But what I was curious about is, like, how has travel helped to shape your worldview and maybe influence the way that you work with people? Because it sounds like a lot of the work you do is very much communication and just like talking with, I assume, a lot of different types of people and trying to meet them, you know, wherever they're at. And to me, I'm like, you know, if you have traveled a lot and been experiencing different cultures, experiencing different people and languages. Maybe that sets your mind up in a different way to be able to kind of engage with people on a different level. But I'm curious from you, like, does travel influence the way you work?
It does a lot because, so I mentioned growing up, my dad was an immigrant. He fled Vietnam when Saigon fell in 75. My mom was a refugee. She was a boat person. They met in California.
Oh, wow.
So I grew up quite poor. And on top of that, my dad was a paraplegic. He was a stroke victim. So I grew up taking care of him, you know, like feeding him, changing him, everything, like as a caregiver for 20 years of my life. So because of this, like being poor and having to take care of my dad, especially on the weekends when my mom worked cutting hair, I kind of yearned for what was out there because, you know, I was like very kind of isolated. I was the only child, so I felt very alone. And so I was like, that I think helped facilitate creativity in the sense of like I was by myself. I had to learn, you know, come up with like ideas for myself to play with toys kind of stuff or whatever. But I also like yearned to be out there to kind of see what was out there. Yeah. So I finally got a chance. I was 16. I was a foreign exchange student in Germany for a year and a half. And then, so I just kept traveling and just kept trying to see things and taking life in because having experienced it with my dad, like it can be taken away from you at any point.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So there was that yearning. But then the other part of it is that I would see something and it would just like pique my curiosity and like I would just want to like incorporate it somehow. Mm-hmm. So I forget what the name of the place is in Montreal, but I want to say Vasily or something like that. It's this like old school like burger joint. They just make like sliders essentially.
Oh, cool.
It's been around since like 1910 or something like that, right?
Oh, wow.
And they have their process down. Like there's certain things in that. And if you break the process, which is like, I don't want mustard on my burger, they charge you more.
Ooh, okay.
And the reason why is because you're messing with our workflow.
Yeah, sure.
We're slower because you're changing up how we do things.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, this is great. Let's do that.
Yeah.
Like, because now it facilitates the conversation of like, well, why are you charging me more? It's like, we have this process for a reason.
Right. Mm-hmm.
It works. Mm-hmm. It's worked for everybody else that we've done this with. Like, I know you're unique, you're a snowflake, but your problems are very similar to everybody else's. Like, we just have to solve it uniquely for you.
Yeah.
But the process works.
Yes.
Like if it doesn't work, I wouldn't use it.
Exactly.
Like so and you're just making it harder for me to do my job.
Right.
And you're also pulling me away from doing other work because I have to do something differently. So you're gonna get charged more. So we do that with like copy. So we're like, we're gonna write copy for you because copy is the biggest like bottleneck for websites and everybody thinks they can write. So we'll write the copy. If you write the copy, we'll charge you more.
Wow. I'm having one of those mind blown emoji moments right now.
I see the logic so much though.
It makes a lot of sense. I mean, is this what you say to your client? You say it just like you just, laid it out.
I just lay it out. I mean, there's no point in getting around. Like,
just
be honest with it. It's like, we're going to charge you more. Like the biggest issue with websites is no one's ever has copy. And the other part of it is like, what am I designing to? Like, I'm just going to be throwing sections onto a web page. Like,
context.
Yeah. It's like, you know why these websites like feel disjointed and don't feel like great experiences? It's because they wrote the copy afterwards and nobody knew what to design to.
Content. Yeah. Wow. Okay.
So like I liken it to it's like shooting a movie without a script. Like there's some directors who can do that well, but
very few.
But very few. Like there's like Wong Kar-wai and like that's it.
Same.
Right? Like that's
pretty
it.
Yeah.
So
I love that. Well, I honestly, I hope more people listen to this episode who are planning to start
and hire Huck Finch.
And hire Huck Finch. Because honestly, I mean, just as a designer, you know, I look at a lot of websites, I look at a lot of designs, and, you know, I work in tech, and most tech businesses have some kind of corporate website. And so many of the, you know, kind of underlying issues that we see in terms of, you know, website design, messaging, user experience, fundamentally come because that strategy is not in place at the start of things. It's because people just say, hey, we need a website and we're going to cobble it together as we go.
Yeah.
And so I love how you're kind of breaking things down in terms of, you know, this is the way that we think it should be done. This is how we see it works and we're going to do it. And, you know, if you don't like it, then it kind of is what it is. You can always do whatever you want to after the job is done, but you've hired us for our vision and for our strategy. And that's what we're going to deliver to give you the best possible product and best possible way to scale as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And like back to the travel thing a little bit more too, like on top of like going to places like this, like part of the big thing that we try to have as our differentiator is the client experience. Like, yeah. And part of that is facilitated by going to, you know, not only Michelin star restaurants, but like you get that Michelin experience of like, yeah. You know, like I somehow was able to go to, like, was fortunate enough to go to like the French Laundry, which is like really hard to get into. Yeah. But like, while the meal was great, what I was mostly curious about when I got there was like, what is the experience going to be like? Because mm-hmm. when you go to a place like that, it's not just the food, it's everything. It's everything, yeah. So like, how can I create everything to like feel like this like high end mm-hmm. experiential thing where, you know, you, when you work with Huck Finch, like I tell people right away, it's like, I want to set you up for success where you can take over this website confidently, but you love working with so much that you would never want to fire us. Mm-hmm. That's the dichotomy. Mm-hmm. That's the mm-hmm. struggle that you're going to have. Is like, I can take over this website, but I love working with Hein and Matt too much to like fire them. So like, how do I make that experience? Right. And part of it is like, I know you're wearing a million hats. Yeah. Your neck is heavy with hats. Mm-hmm. You shouldn't have to worry about the website. You shouldn't ever feel like you're in the dark. Like, how can I create that experience? And we're still, you know, very focused on thinking through that and how we want to create that experience for people and what we can do before and after mm-hmm. working with us. But yeah, just like these travels and these experiences kind of like, well, how can we incorporate something like this into the business? Maybe it doesn't have to be exactly this, but sure. something like this.
Inspiration. Yeah. No, I love that.
Now I am curious how you got into French Laundry and all these Michelin star places I saw that you were going to in Japan. Yeah. All the food photos.
Yeah, French Laundry was just random. I tried to get in and then I just pulled it up one day when I was home and then there were seats available. And I think what happens is that like a lot of these like high-end places, like the bots just kind of like lock them up and then they're not going to go and they try to resell them and then they can't. They like just release them.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Okay. So then now they're randomly available. So sometimes like 48 hours ahead, you might be able to get lucky. You know?
Pro tip.
Yeah.
Pro tip. For getting in at French Laundry.
There you go. Next time we're on the West Coast.
Yes.
But how do you do what you do on the daily basis? Like what are the tools and resources that you fall back on that you're employing?
Yeah. So we build on Webflow, so that's mm-hmm. Our website platform. So if I'm in anything, I'm in Webflow, I'm in Figma, I'm probably in Google Sheets because that's more on the operational side of things, sure. for running numbers and business. And then the other tool that I use regularly is Toggle. We track our time, because like you can't measure what you don't sure. have number wise, yeah. and so we were very conscientious about like tracking our time on everything that we do. So then I can look back and think about profitability. Like, did we do this as efficiently as we could have? You know, this number was lower. Why is that? Like, versus like other times, like what can we tweak here? Mm-hmm. And so it's just that constant, like every day wanting to get better, like every day can be 1% better. And mm-hmm. I think that's part of like, I forget what the Japanese word is for it, but like it's essentially that idea of craftsmanship, right? Like every day right. you can create something and then the next time you're like, I just want to make it better than I did the last time. Mm. So that's that constant kind of thinking. But yeah, the day usually starts with like me figuring out like, what is my one goal today? Mm-hmm. Like, and I think that harkens back to the chill pill thing where like we get so bogged down with all the things that we want to do in a day. And I just like try to think about like, if I can do one thing today, and get that accomplished, what would set me up for success? And I try to get that done right away. And so every day, at the rest of the day, it's like, hey, maybe I've got nothing else done. I know I got the thing I wanted done. So mm-hmm. it's all good. It was a good day.
Have you picked up any other skill sets as you run your business? Like obviously you work in Webflow and Figma, you're a designer, but is there anything else that you've kind of had to pick up along the way to make the work happen?
I think like the biggest skill set that I kind of had to pick up was the sales, like being able to talk to people.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's a big one.
Yeah. Cause I think like for me, like, you know, like I think as most probably designers and people who just want to do stuff, it's like the sales is like the worst part because like, it's like, you don't want to talk about money. Like, it's like, mm-hmm. I just want to make shit, like, right. you know, sorry for cursing, but,
authentic.
But at the end of the day, like, I can't make stuff and keep the lights on if I don't make sales. Right. Like, so it's very much about like, this isn't slimy. If it this isn't bad. Mm-hmm. And the other part of it helped me realize too, especially coming as a non-designer, is that like, I think too many designers think about the non-design part of a business as like unsexy and uncool, mm-hmm. and it keeps them from doing the creative stuff. Mm-hmm. And really at the end of the day, it's what facilitates the ability to do the creative.
Of course.
And part of our overall goal and mission as we kind of like grow and scale like Chill Pill Holdings, as we add more service lines and businesses, is that we want to be able to get creatives to see that the non-creative stuff can be sexy as the creative stuff. Mm-hmm. Like if you know how to make it fun and sexy, like I love staring at numbers now, like in the profitability. It's like, it jazzes me up. Like I can go to Matt and talk about it. Like it just gets me going. Just the same way that it gets me going. Like if I can get something to work in Webflow, like a script mm-hmm. or something like that. Like it's that same level. Once you understand that contextually why it matters and you get enough reps in it, like, mm-hmm. It's like that whole thing was passion. Like for me, like I hate the follow your passion thing because like, like you don't become passionate about something until like you do it enough times, mm-hmm. like you build reps into it, then it becomes a thing. Like when I first played trombone, like did I have a passion to play trombone? No, but like over the years and over the time invested into it, like I loved it. It was very much a passion of mine. Mm-hmm. Like
repetition.
Yeah. The repetition, but also then I'll occasionally say, I was passionate about being an astronaut. Like when I was like five, like where am I now? Like I was passionate playing with my like Ninja Turtle toys, like not doing that, you know? So like passion changes.
We're not Ninja Turtles yet.
Yeah.
Yeah. Last season we had a whole episode on how to price. And a few minutes ago you said something about Toggle and the timekeeping. Are you timekeeping for yourself or are you timekeeping for your clients' knowledge?
For myself.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Then that aligns with what we talked about in season one, right? Mm-hmm. I don't know if you heard the episode with Lynette, but she said the hourly keeping is not a good way to structure your invoicing because let's say you're less experienced. Taking longer doesn't mean that you're getting something better.
Yep.
Right. So if you're inexperienced getting paid more, that doesn't really jive. That, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. No, I totally agree with that. Like, I think it's, for me, like I'm a reverse engineering type person. Mm-hmm, so mm-hmm. I look at it like, okay, there's gross margins and there's net mm-hmm. margins. Gross.
Yep.
The simplest way is just the cost of you doing the work, you know, your salary, and then net is everything else, right? Your subscriptions, rent, utilities, all that stuff. So if I want my gross margins to be 20% of my business, if I know what my salary is, you can just, you know, do the math backwards and you know how much that needs to be. Mm-hmm. And you know, there's only so much time in a year, mm-hmm. approximately 2000 working hours. You can't be billable 100% of the time. So we try to be 50-50 because we want to do client work and also work in the business. So then you just keep reversing that math until you get to your hourly rate and what it needs to be in order to hit the number that you need to hit in order for your gross margins to be 20%. So then now you have it set up versus kind of like, oh, I'll set it up as like 150. Like we started with that direction. I'm not going to lie and say that's not how we started. But when I did this math, I realized like I was off by like $100, $100 an hour of what our hourly rate, what we had priced for everything was lower than what it needed to be for me to have this margin. So I was like, why need to increase my price?
Right. This guy's spreadsheets.
Yeah. I mean, we're not going to write out this formula on the website. So everybody go back and re-listen to just what Hank just said.
Yes.
That makes so much sense. I mean, time really is the barrier to our productivity. Mm-hmm. And so I remember in the tech talk that you gave a few years ago, you talked about how many days we have, right? And I'm so enamored by this idea, like doing things not only with intentionality, but spending our work life doing things with intentionality. Can you talk about what, like, you were an ordained Buddhist monk?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that was a temporary thing. So, you know, I was the first in my family to go to college. And so I very much told my mom, hey, if this happens, you know, like there wasn't any reason why it wouldn't have happened, but it was very much like kind of this is a thing that like I was fortunate enough, you know, growing in not the best neighborhoods, growing up with bad influences around me. I could have very much gone down a different direction with my life. And so, you know, a lot of kind of like Marvel multiverse kind of like one action thing could have lead down a different thing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, for my life to turn out the way that it did, where I got to go to college and got to get in some good schools that I wanted to get back to, you know, whatever forces that led me down this direction. So I became ordained as a temporary, like a monk temporarily for a summer, like over a few weeks back home. So it's more of a common practice in South Asian like countries like Laos, Thailand, and Cambodia. East Asian, not so much. Usually, that's more like if you're ordained, then you're ordained. You're stuck there. Where in the other countries, like it's more of a rite of passage. Like men typically go through, do it for a little bit as they kind of grow up, as a means to kind of like learn how to be good husbands, good men as they grow up. So I was like, so I knew we had like Laotian, like Cambodian, like monasteries around. So I was like, went and did that.
It's like a rite of passage. That's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. I took it as a rite of passage. Kind of like, oh, like, you know, I'm going into college. I'm going to this thing that no one I know in my family has ever done. So I get to kick that off by doing this thing.
Wow. Very cool.
Cool.
What do you think is in the future for the landscape of work that you do? Yeah. Like, what would you tell a young person that's breaking into it now that would be useful for the future?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing I can say is that, like, you know, there's obviously a lot of like conversations about AI and where all that is. And I think for the short term, like, it'll be problematic because I think people will, you know, see what they can do with AI versus going with like a real designer or copywriter, photographer. But ultimately, if you know how AI works, then you you kind of realize that like this can only go so far because it's gonna just wants. It's like at the a friend like Jack Virick, like SEO guy, like he basically was talking about like the best you're gonna get from an SEO standpoint from AI is always gonna be like a junior SEO person because like they don't know the intricacies and it's just gonna keep pulling and pulling from other stuff that's like junior level. So you're never gonna get like the high end level kind of stuff.
That's a good point.
So as my point is that I think at some point a lot of businesses people will realize that, like, I can use this for particular things, but I can't substitute this for the actual things that I want.
Right.
It's kind of like going back to the French Laundry things, like, can I make some similar things like that? Maybe. Like, I can go to a place that probably could do that, but if I want the French Laundry experience, I need to go to the French Laundry.
Exactly.
So there's no substitute.
And AI can't necessarily help you think strategically, build something consistent at scale. Like, maybe it can be a tool to give you an idea, but it can't kind of handhold you through that whole process in a way that you'd be confident.
Yeah, and it's just going to end up being like a bubble where, like, you know, if everyone's just like using AI to generate their LinkedIn posts, then every LinkedIn post is going to be AI generated.
Like,
and who is talking to each other? No one's talking to each other. So people are just going to be like, I think there's like someone that we're seeing where like a lot of Gen Z where they're going a little bit more analog with things. Like, they're playing. I see kids with like disposable cameras now.
Cameras.
Right. Yeah. Cinematic. I'm like, this is cool. It's like, because they're like, I want to see something tangible and touch something. And like, it's like, that's.
Please do.
And understand the process behind the lens.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I guess I have one sort of, I guess, funnish question for you. Is there another career that you would have wanted to take had you not ended up where you are?
You know, I didn't expect to end up where I am. So I don't really know, like, if I have a good answer for that. Cause like, I think that's the other thing. It's like, I mentor a lot of I try to pay forward where like I am today. Like, I'm only here because the community like supported and I got referrals and word of mouth. Like, people like Pete Baker would send people work my way, and we had never worked together, but we just vibed. He had a good relationship with me. He trusted me and people trust him. And so because of this, I try to pay it forward by, you know, like giving back to the community where I can. And a lot of times I work with like kids at U of M and they're so worried about like, I don't know what I'm doing with my life and blah, blah, blah. I'm just like, the reality is like, no one does.
Right.
Yeah, we're all figuring it out still, right? Yeah. So I didn't know that I would get here. And so, I don't really know if there's a good answer for me to say.
That's
like,
a perfect answer.
I would have done something else differently.
Yeah.
No, I would have been our doctor.
Yeah. I think I would have been an unhappy doctor for sure.
Unhappy doctor.
Oh, no. How many of those are out there, I wonder?
Too many, unfortunately. Yeah. I did a talk about this where it was like, You know, like, I think, like, for me, at least, like, I could at least say, like, I wanted to be a doctor because I had a dad who was a paraplegic. I was in hospitals all the time. And I knew I want to change his experience because his patient care experience sucked, and I wanted to do something about it.
Yeah.
But a lot of kids, like, want to be doctors probably because legacy things or things it's a good job, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, so it's like anything in life is like, you got to test, figure out a way to test this out, right? See if this actually really is true. So I had this like talk, and I was basically like, how do you really know you want to be a doctor? Mm. Like, what have you done to validate that this dream is actually where you want to go? Because even for me, like, I wanted to be in healthcare. I was driven with something that was very personal, but then ultimately I realized, like, this isn't the right path for me. Mm. And I could have ended down somewhere that would have been totally wrong for me. I would have invested a lot of time, a lot of money into this thing that was just bad, right? So I think just like anything in life, like, you just try it out. Just try it out first. Like, try it out, figure it out, and then pivot if you have to.
Shoot your shot.
Yeah.
If you like this podcast, be sure to heart, like, and subscribe to Cadence wherever you listen to podcasts. Follow us on Instagram at CadencePod, or check out our episodes and more at thecadencepod.com. While we are proudly based in Ypsilanti, Michigan, we are recording out of Fifth Avenue Studios in Ann Arbor at Ann Arbor District Library. And we hope wherever you're creating from in the world, you are marching to your own cadence. Thanks for listening.